And a very pleasant good morning. Welcome back into Quicksand this morning. We're now at 8:33. We've got sunshine. We've got 27 degrees. And we have Randolph County Prosecuting Attorney Mike Fusselman in the studio. How are you, Mike?
Doing good.
Can you believe time is winding down?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like 28 years.
All right. Hey, take us through how this whole thing, and this isn't the real reason we're here, but as long as you're here, how did it get started for you to become the prosecutor?
It started back when I was a police officer. I was a detective with the Moberly Police Department, and I worked there for 8 years back in 78 through 85. And some of my professors had convinced me to go back to law school or go to law school and get a law degree, struggling with cases, getting results we wanted to see. And they said the only way you do that is if you get the right initials behind your name. So I did go to law school up at UMKC, came back here, and had a couple years of experience in Boone County as an assistant prosecutor under Joe Mosley.
All right. What was that like? Because I knew Joe as a state senator.
You know, he was everything you saw about him when you see him on TV or whatever. He's exactly that way. In fact, we were so tight for space, he shared his office with me. We had like 9 assistant prosecutors back at that time. I had one little space next to a restroom in a library for a while, and I think he felt sorry for me, so I got to stay in a different office with him for a short time while they were doing some renovations. This is probably one of the earlier renovations. It's a completely different building now.
So was your goal the whole time you were down there, and it wasn't very long, to come up here and become prosecutor?
From the beginning, when I made up my mind as an officer that I wanted to be a prosecutor, that was the direction I went into, yes.
So how has that office changed from when you started, what, 28 years ago to now?
Well, we had 2 prosecutors, one assistant and me. Diane Painter was the assistant prosecutor. And then we had 2 staff. So we only had 4 people working the office. A lot of regulations changed, a lot of requirements of what we do in terms of legal filings and discovery obligations, the type of things we have to go out and find and make available to the defense. You know what happens now. You see it on TV all the time where we have the audio and video recordings from, you know, local gas station or businesses or the ones the officers wear now that they have cop view cameras. And all of that stuff has to be monitored and shared with the defense. The discovery is probably the biggest change that we've seen in the last 28 years.
All right, is your side of law enforcement like everything else? There's more paperwork to do?
Absolutely, except it's digitized paperwork, if you want to put it that way.
Is that good for you?
It just means a lot more resources. Right now, our staff is up. We're around, our office is probably, and I'm estimating here, but I think we're about 9 or 10. You know, we have part-time help too, but it takes that to keep up with everything that's going on. You have a lot of obligations.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you could probably use a half dozen more to handle the volume of cases you have.
Ideally, there are a couple other spots we would like to have, and it would especially help in terms of making sure we're being complete and meeting Brady and Giglio requirements, which are part of the discovery obligations. But, I know in Columbia, they are a little tighter on monitoring all of the traffic that comes through in the jails and what have you. We don't have the resources to do all that. And I just don't know. We're trying to find out where the line is. The language of the new rules on discovery is a little general in some areas, so we're not clear on exactly where that line ends.
Okay, I want to test your memory here. How many judges have you gone through?
Well, when I started, when I was a police officer, I had Sam Semple, and then I had Channing Bloyer, both as an officer and then as a prosecutor until he retired. Ralph Janes came in behind him, and then, of course, Scott Hayes took the position after that.
All right, so there really have not been a whole lot of different judges in your tenure, have there?
No, everybody that comes in, and it's not unusual as a presiding judge, they tend to stay. And don't forget, the presiding judge, it's a 6-year term, so once you've served 2 terms, you've already had 12 years in.
All right, I know you've worked with some other judges. Cindy Souter is one you've worked with. Mason Gebhardt's another one.
True, and of course, I get to work with a lot of the judges from the surrounding counties, Judge Mobley, Judge Rachel Bringer Shepherd, Terry Shannon, and Judge Vandeluk over in Sheraton, Sullivan County. Occasionally, I get to go up to Macon, not so much anymore, more often when it was Hadley Grimm and Ron Belt, and then further north up into Kirksville.
Do you approach what you do differently based on the judge then?
Yes. In fact, it starts in the beginning when we start deciding what kind of case it is and what the facts are. You have to understand the judges and their philosophies. I think every judge tries to be fair, but they're just like you or me. They have past experiences that they rely on in making their decisions. And so you have to know how they think and how they view things. And I try to make sure that I make the right decisions about the types of cases I put before those judges.
All right. One thing we're not going to do with Mike today is talk about specific cases. You're not allowed to talk about those, are you, a whole lot?
No.
All right. Let me ask you a general question. You know where I'm going with this. There was a big trial held this past year or two that took up about 2 weeks of time. That takes a lot of resources from the county, doesn't it? And from the Attorney General's office in this case.
It does. Some cases take longer. There are times when you have legal issues that come up, and then you have to kind of put the trial case on pause because you need to get an answer for whether evidence is coming in or not. That means you're going to go to the Court of Appeals, and that process adds a year and a half, 2 years to a case pretty quickly.
And there was another case that involved the Attorney General's office this past week, too, a civil commitment for someone. And my question is this, not about that case, but how closely do prosecutors work with the AG's office?
We have a very good working relationship. You know, when those types of cases come up, there is a panel that meets to make decisions about whether they go forward with that type of case. And the prosecutor from the county where that case will be heard is involved in that decision making.
Okay, how valuable is it to have the AG as a resource, especially when you're talking about a high-level felony case?
It's when it comes to resources and the paper chase involved, for example, in homicides, they have all that in their background already. So instead of reinventing the wheel, it's always great to have that support. And they try those cases more, so they know what types of issues they'll likely see. There, you know, I got to work with Bob Ossens and Kenny Holsoff back in the 90s, and the benefit of that was learning how to try the most serious cases and then stealing from them all the different ideas that work and implementing them in my lesser cases, felony and misdemeanor, until I got it down. So it was a very good relationship. You know, we've had some other cases that were very complicated. And deal with more regulatory matters that we don't see on a regular basis. And you would probably think of somebody who was involved in a project here recently that didn't go so well, the MAMTEC project. And when it comes down to finding the witnesses, and we're talking about out of the United States, and finding ways, legal tools for getting certain things done, they have that knowledge base behind them that helps you to get that done.
Mike, you've been at this game, and I call it a game, it's not, but you've been at this for 28 years. Do you find people from all across the state calling you for advice?
Well, that's the thing. We always kind of share information. We learn as much between the trainings that we go to, which we have in the fall and the spring, just by getting together as prosecutors and also with other disciplines and just trading information, sharing what's going on. So it's always been beneficial to have that kind of relationship.
So who did you kind of look up to you when you started this? Was it Joe Mosley?
Well, I had Joe Mosley. I mean, I was spoiled. I had Tom Osborne in Audrain County, who'd been a longtime prosecutor by that time. I had Jim Foley up north in Macon County. I had Joe Mosley, and then after him, Kevin Crane, somebody that I'd started. He started like 6 months after I did in Boone County. And quickly rose to the prosecutor level. Now, of course, he's a judge in Boone County.
Yeah, and what was it like when you got to work with Kenny Holsoff? Because I knew him as a congressman in the late 90s.
You know, all the attorneys have different styles of presenting cases. And whereas, for example, Bob Ossens reminds me of a lot of judges that are just, or a lot of prosecutors that are like a Joe Friday, just the facts kind of guy. Kenny had a lot of flourish, and he could bring the emotion into it, and he was very good at making compelling arguments, very compelling.
All right, what do we tell folks about the court procedure? It's not like what you see on TV, and the example I always give, it's not Quincy.
Well, it's not near as exciting, obviously. People complain to me about the length of the court proceedings that we go through, but if you're in the system and you're understanding what's going on, because of the amount of time and care that's taken in going through those cases, you avoid having problems down the road where the charge is, where there's a reversal of the case, you have to come back and redo things. So on the felony level, you're going to see that it takes longer with each individual case to process it than if it's a traffic case or a misdemeanor. There are more steps in the process, more rules that have to be utilized to make sure that you get the job done right.
Is it hard for the person on the outside who's not directly involved and just hears on the radio, Joe Blow's been arrested for this, and they wonder, why aren't they in jail right now? Well, that person still has rights, don't they?
Right. In fact, more often than not, when somebody talks about a new investigation, you'll see something, a tail at the end of it, that indicates that they have the presumption of innocence until they've been found guilty. And it's kind of hard when you hear the facts. It's like a lot of allegations you hear anymore. You may get the details very briefly. And
the Reader's Digest version.
Yeah, or just basically the talking points that one agenda wants you to hear. And that isn't the whole story. And a lot of times you may see that pitch made by attorneys representing a different party, and then down the road you see that the case comes out with a different result, and it turns out that the state was doing everything correctly in the beginning. But, you know, I think time kind of moves on, and most of the public don't see that because they've moved on with their lives. I mean, they're in the moment, it's important to them when they hear it the way it's presented to them. But as time goes on, I think they lose track of that. So they don't really hear the final answer on those cases.
And is it frustrating, too, when I'm guessing you get stopped in every single store you go to saying, hey, Mike, what's going on here? What's going on with that? And you can't say anything about it.
You know, I don't get that so much. What has happened a lot more recently, and I think this is true especially with our drug court program, is I have folks that come up to me, and they're not just thanking me, but really they're just thanking us as a county for giving them a shot, even with the struggles they've had in the past. It's nice to see the success stories. You don't appreciate them so much if you're the judge or the prosecutor, because when they are successful, all of a sudden you stop seeing them. And so it's kind of surprising 5, 7, 8 years later when you suddenly see that individual, and I mean, I've seen them from all walks of life, and suddenly you realize they've been successful, that things have been moving along, and they finally overcome those challenges, and they're doing great.
All right, how about the drug court? How valuable has that been?
I think it is a valuable tool. You know, the things that changed with the drug court is originally when we implemented it, I think that the people that were coming into the court were those who were likely going to be successful anyhow, maybe first-time offenders. See, that's true with DWIs as well. If you look at the statistics, generally speaking, the majority of your DWI offenders or your drug offenders, you'll never see again. And so it might have puffed up the stats for success. And as time went on, the folks that fund these things and put these programs together said, you know, you really need to start taking on the tougher ones, because we're using our resources here and we want to make sure they're going to the best use. And you're looking at more intensive supervision, more financial resources, counseling, etc. And I think it was a good move. Now, it means your numbers went down in terms of success, but you're given the opportunity where it probably is needed the most that way. You're not spending it where you really didn't need to in the first place.
All right. How valuable are groups, Mike, like the North Missouri Drug Task Force?
They help us a lot. One side benefit of Drug Task Force is that you end up clearing drug cases, but the folks that we see in drug cases aren't exclusively criminals involved in drug activity. And I think that's lost on people. When you see all these stats about throwing substance abusers in jail, those are also our property criminals, our domestic violence offenders. They're all the same names. It's just that they also happen to get picked up for drug violations. But sometimes when we don't have the ability to make a victim strong enough to come in and testify, a drug buy accomplishes that. And all I need is the tape and the officer and the CI. And so there's more than one way to skin that cat. These people are still out there committing crimes. We just put our resources where we can make the most effective response.
Okay, we're going to take a break here in just a second. What is the drug of choice these days? It used to be in the 90s we were talking methamphetamine. Has that changed?
I think we still see meth cases, but we don't see near the manufacturing. I think all of that is done, you know, out of states, or maybe there are a few little operations here and there. Majority of the things we see are pharmaceutical. I mean, it's easy to get. Xanax, the opioids, it's all over the place. You've seen the stories about Florida. We had some people just a couple years ago that were driving from Tennessee and Kentucky to Florida to get the prescriptions and then driving up 63 Highway looking for pharmacies where they might get lucky and somebody might be able to fill that script for them, and they try to reuse the same script over and over again. And they harvest all of that, and then the person in charge takes them back down and gives that to whoever was funding them coming up in the first place. It's a lucrative business for folks that aren't doing anything else with their lives. They get things taken care of financially for a little bit. We had a lot of that going on here, and you've probably seen the stats. There are a lot of other states where it's even worse.
All right, here's your only political question I'll ask you. Would a PDMP help that?
It sure would. Sounds like there might be another shot coming up this year, but I've been down this road about 5 or 6 years now. Some of the folks running interference won't be in the way this time, but I just don't know. I'll wait until it happens.
All right, Randolph County Prosecuting Attorney Mike Fossman with us. We'll have more in just a moment.
The Gravely Atlas is one mean, lean, working machine. It's the ultimate work vehicle, and right now, save big bucks during the Model Year Sales event at Failing Small Engine in Salisbury. This is Aaron, and through October 31st, save an additional $1,500 on the JSV 6000 and $1,000 on the JSV 3000. And that's in addition to 0% financing for up to 48 months. See it, drive it, buy it. Get your Atlas now at Failing Small Engine, Highway 24 West, Salisbury.
Right now at Moberly Napa, check out the biggest holiday sale ever. On sale now, Evercraft 36-piece quarter-inch Drive Master sockets at only $18.99. Evercraft 30-piece quarter and 3/8-inch SAE and metric sockets at only $13.99. Valvoline Premium Blue heavy-duty diesel motor oil, $12.99 a gallon. ISO Heat Premium Fuel Antifreeze and Injector Cleaner, $209. Biggest holiday sale ever for your car, truck, or van. Napa Auto Parts in Moberly. Get the good stuff.
This is probably the most important radio ad you will ever hear. This is Andy Bush with Macon Atlanta State Bank in Macon and Monroe City. When you use our app to do your banking, all your bank information stays secure. Your banking is done on the app, not on the phone or tablet. And when you close the app, all your information remains on our computer, not on your phone or tablet. And that's important because no one can pick up your phone and access your bank accounts. It all happens here at Macon Atlanta State Bank in Macon and Monroe City. Member FDIC and Equal Housing Lender.
We're back with Randolph County Prosecuting Attorney Mike Fossman. One of the reasons we wanted to have here, and this could be an emotionally charged discussion, we want to talk about some of the child molestation cases and things like that without getting specific. And Mike, some of these cases can take a while to come out, can't they?
They can. You know, as we've gone along, I was part of what I guess we'll call one of our first multidisciplinary teams back in the 80s. And what we did is we really worked these cases at the front end when the hotline first came in. Just worked it until it was done. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to lock in a lot of information. We didn't know about delayed disclosures back then. We didn't have that kind of research coming in to support what we were doing. So we were successful, but there were probably a lot of cases that we were not successful for, but we didn't know why. We didn't know why the kids weren't telling us what was going on. We now know that disclosure is a process. And there are a lot of dynamics that happen in the home or in that child's environment that affects when they are ready to disclose. A large number of our cases, we may get front-end details that help us to know there's a crime that we can go ahead and start prosecuting. But 6 months or a year later, when the child is out of that environment and feels safe and kind of has an idea of what can happen if they make a disclosure, they get more comfortable and they're able to start sharing more details.
And that doesn't always happen after the person who's accused of the crime is removed from the home, does not right away.
Not right away. What's going on, we talked to all these kids, so we have a better understanding, look at all the counseling reports and what have you. And really what happens is that kid has to be in a position where they do believe they're not just simply going to get returned to that home because they know there are consequences if that happens. It's a very tough situation because if you don't prove the case, there's always a risk the child gets returned to the home. And then we don't know what's happening in that house.
The question I get more than anything else from people, are there more of these cases now or are we just hearing more about them?
You know, I think the investigative approach is different. I don't think there's any difference in the number. I saw something recently that suggested there was. What I've also noticed, though, and I've noticed this over time when we changed regulations on DWIs and how we handle those, is you see a difference in the number of cases made. So it's all in what brings attention to those cases. And I don't think that's a fair reflection of what's actually happening out in the community.
Okay, how tough are these cases to prove in court?
I think child abuse cases are the toughest case you can try in criminal prosecution. I think homicides are easier. Now, Kevin Crane, even when he first came in, I think he would have told you the same thing. He would tell you homicide isn't rocket scientists. They don't need rocket scientists to make those cases. But with child abuse, there are a lot of dynamics there. And there's that initial reluctance on the part of some people to believe a child when they tell you something. And so if you look at the entire process and the rules of procedure we have for getting child testimony in, if you think about it, we don't require that of kids that are 18 or of adults. And you have to ask yourself sometimes why. Why do we make these kids jump through all these hoops? It comes back to some cases from the 80s. And if you go back and you look at those cases, you may find in those daycare cases that what we were all told in the beginning wasn't true. And it created an overreaction to this distrust for children, what they have to say. Now, I'm not going to tell you the opposite either. I'm not going to tell you blindly accept what kids say. But I am going to say that kids don't create the court system. Kids don't create the rules of evidence. But you want to make these kids come in and jump through all these hoops and be re-traumatized just to protect them and to bring some justice for the things that have happened to them. I think we can keep working on making that a better situation for them.
Let me ask you, Mike, you've obviously seen things and heard things, either videotape or in-person interviews that people can only imagine. How tough is it to leave that at the office and not bring it home?
You know, it's something I've done since I was in my 20s. It became a lot more of a challenge once I started having my own children. And I can think of a few other professionals that, you know, started their adult lives with families about the same time I did. I mean, we kind of shared the same thing. We noticed that it got a lot tougher to handle certain types of cases once you were going home at night, and there you were sitting down with your own children and having a bit of family time anyhow. It changes the way you see things.
All right. Let me ask you, we got about 3 minutes or so left in the program. What's your advice for Stephanie Lunsford as she takes over the first of the year?
I'm not going to give her any advice. You know, the prosecutor has to kind of set their policies and aim for what they think is important philosophically for them to accomplish. Stephanie has the benefit of being around this community for a long time, and she has some ideas that she's going to explore. But I think she is firm in her direction, and I think she knows what she wants to get done, so I'm going to let her define that.
All right, how about the caseload in Randolph County? Would the average citizen understand how big it really is?
I don't think so, because I remember some former commissioners years ago who seemed to think that you looked at the number of cases charged and that told you how busy people were. And what they don't understand is there are the reports that come in that we have to review. A large number of reports, there may be more work that gets done as you go along, or we're working with a variety of agencies to get the work done. And so what it takes to process the case is different now than it was in 1991 when I first came into office. All of the things about each case are different. And I already mentioned the discovery. Well, that's one component. There are other obligations we have with the state now, things that didn't exist when I started office.
All right. What's the best part about being a prosecutor for you?
You know, I think for me, the important thing about being a prosecutor was making a difference in the lives of kids and protecting them more than anything else. And I felt that way with domestic assault, elderly abuse. You know, typically with the elder abuse and the domestic assault, or with the elder abuse and the child abuse, you have people who are being victimized by virtue of where they are, their station in life. And they didn't bring that on themselves. They had no ability to control the situation. I think those are the people we need to make sure we take care of.
Was it worthwhile for you when you had either that person or a relative of theirs come up to you and just say thanks?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't say that I ever was unhappy when anybody came up. The addicts, you know, if you look at the total environment, all of these families, you know, they're facing their challenges in different ways. Some by physical violence in the home, some by the substance abuse issues, and sometimes a combination of all those things. So, you know, if they're successful, we're satisfied with the work we've done.
All right. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for the time. Enjoy the last week and a half on the job.
Thank you.
All right, Randolph County Prosecuting Attorney Mike Fusselman, he's joined us today on Quicksland This Morning.